Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm here twice a month, and I guess when we do seven principles, that takes a long time. And what I've noticed is that the seven principles that we use to guide and direct us in our lives, they're difficult. And I think this particular principle tells either whether we do live out of the principles, whether they are part of our life, or whether we speak these principles and these values don't touch our hearts. In the first five principles, in the first three principles, we talked about how they're about inner transformation, how about our lives are changed. We talked about the inherent worth and dignity of every person. But first, that means that we hold ourselves with dignity and we hold ourselves with a sense of worth, so that there's an inner reconciliation within who we are as individuals. And when we talked about peace and justice, and we talked about compassion, and how do we have compassion for ourselves, which we're talking about our inner lives. And last time I spoke, we talked about democracy and the democratic process, and about how the democratic process is the beginning of externalizing our inner worlds. It's the beginning of how we talk to one another. And if we talk to one another in ways that are kind, in ways that are encouraging, in ways that are encouraging to spiritual growth, we know that there has been healing in our inner world and that there is peace within our inner world. Now we're talking about the community of world peace, liberty, and justice. Can you see it? Can you see a world community of peace? Can you see your home at peace? Can you see your neighborhood at peace? Can you see your region at peace? Can you see peace on a street corner when we're carrying signs, marching, protesting? Where can you see peace? Can you see peace, and can you feel peace within yourself? For as we talked early on when we were working with the principles, do we have that inner conflict? Is there an intense self-judgment going on within you, which would indicate there's not peace within ourselves, within yourself? Can we see a world community of peace? So I go on the internet and I look up world peace. And we do not have in this country a lot of communication to other parts of the world talking about world peace. It's just not there. The ones I did find, I enjoyed and I liked, and I was really following a couple of threads. One led me back to Reverend Sung Young Moon, and I was reading another one, and it led me back to Reverend Sung Young Moon, and I was reading another one, and it led me back to Reverend Sung Young Moon, and I was reading another one, and there must have been about 20 threads. And I like what I read, and I can see the appeal. And I was reading another one, and it led me back to a yogi. What I didn't find was a movement toward peace that was about the people. It was about individuals with good messages, charismatic individuals. But it wasn't about a sense of peace. There were some movements that said they were about a sense of peace, but stood over and against some other things, which I think is important to do, stand over and against particular things. But yet not something just for peace that was easily attainable to world communication. And then I began to understand, or began to think about, is it possible that there is some kind of conceptual boundary around the United States that censors information and messages from the rest of the world? Could that possibly exist? And then I got scared because I thought, well, yes. And I began to put things together. Are there things in this world that actually stand in the way of world community, of peace, liberty, and justice? Is there an intentionality against peace, liberty, and justice? I can remember, I guess it's 5 or 6 years, probably longer, maybe 10 years ago, Senator Edward Kennedy standing, actually speaking to union members, I forget the union, and he was saying, what does our government have against families? And he was pretty intense and got pretty hysterical about it, but it alerted me to something, to take a look at legislation and see whether it's pro-family or not. And the intensity of his presentation has come to me, except the words are a bit different. What does our culture have against peace? Do we stand over and against peace? I was reading Mother's Day, and there's this Mother's Day proclamation, and it goes like this. Written by a Unitarian woman, Julia Howe. Arise then, women of this day, arise all women who have hearts, whether our baptism be that of water or tears, say firmly, we will not have great questions decided by irrelevant agencies. Our husbands shall not come to us reeking with carnage for caresses and applause. Our sons shall not be taken from us to unlearn all that we have been able to teach them of charity, mercy, and patience. We women of one country will be tender to those of another country, not to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm. The sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Blood does not wipe out dishonor, nor violence indicate possession. As men have often forsaken the plow and the anvil at the summons of war, let women now leave all that may be left of home for a great and earnest day of counsel. Let them meet first as women to bewail and commemorate the dead. Let them solemnly take counsel with each other as to the means whereby the great human family can live in peace, each bearing after their own time the sacred impress, not of Caesar, but of God. In the name of womanhood and of humanity, I earnestly ask that a general Congress of women without limit of nationality may be appointed and held at some place deemed most convenient and at the earliest period consistent with our objectives. To promote alliance of different nationalities, amicable to the settlement of international questions, the great and general interest of peace, 1870. In 1900, we have a movement in churches in this country. The movement said that the ministers of our churches were too effeminate, that they were too nurturing, that they were too caring. It was also a time in our country when we went on the adventure of great imperialism. They said that the ministers needed to be like the captains of industry. They needed to lead our people like captains of football teams. We needed to leave the care and the nurturing behind. Do we stand over and against peace, liberty, and justice? The very words that hypnotize us to do many things that may not even be in the name of peace, liberty, and justice. What is it about us as a culture that stands over and against peace, liberty, and justice, that devalues the voice of women like Juliet Ward Howard, that devalues the voice of care, that devalues the voice of peace? Today we have a congressperson, Dennis Kucinich. Are any of you familiar with Dennis Kucinich? We have something from, it's very similar. And what he has suggested is that in 2001, he first suggested it, He has suggested that we have an establishment of a Department of Peace and Nonviolence. Now, how many congresspersons do we have? 532, I think it is?
34.
34? Well, 43 joined him in this Department of Peace and Nonviolence. 43 people joined him. I never heard about it. It didn't reach the front pages of the newspaper. Congressperson wants to have a peace department. And I got to thinking about a peace department. What a peace department would do, for example, in 1977, we talked before about how Jimmy Carter, after the oil embargo, put forth a plan and energy policy that would have moved us in a direction of being less dependent on oil, period, and also less dependent on the oil from foreign countries, and moving toward alternatives. And in some of his plan, it was the movement and more engagement into coal. But nonetheless, he began to point us in a direction so we could see ourselves as otherwise vulnerable. Otherwise, we would have been on a path that may not have led us to two wars. Both Persian Gulf wars might have been avoided. Another president came after Jimmy Carter and said, no, we don't want that plan. We want a plan committed to oil and have oil be the path of who we are going to be, who we are going to be as a people. If we would have had a peace department, it's not necessarily that the peace department would rule over the War Department or the Energy Department that may be related intimately with the War Department. It would have given us another voice to say there's another way. And that other voice saying that there is another way may have brought those two paths to the public arena so that we could decide as a people of a democracy what is the path that we would prefer to take. The Peace Department would give us another voice, would provide us with alternatives, would not limit our scope to the scope that is given to us possibly by boundaries that censor our imagination only to look in one direction. A peace department toward nonviolence. And if you want to read that, it's absolutely, I think, wonderful. It's cabinet level. It's a secretary appointed by the president. It has an educational process. What I really like about it a lot, because a lot of the different things that he talks about in educational piece against domestic violence and so on and so on, but what he does is he brings continuity to the programs. It is not a program of this community against domestic violence, isolated from this program over here, isolated from this program over here. It's a peace department at the national level, at the federal government level, that has continuity of being able to sit with the leaders of our nation that moves down to the local community. It is not one that stands in isolation, which gives it a greater voice. As a matter of fact, I had the thought that maybe we ought to create a committee, which some people say, oh my God, another committee. But create a committee of persons who would take up issues like this peace department and actually become lobbyists out of our group for peace department, for things like this. That we would have a voice in the community and we would send that voice out there. And that as that voice is moving out into the community, they could come back and report to us what happens. How's that voice received? I would also like to talk about, in the Hebrew sacred text, in the book of Proverbs, chapter 31. It's a curious thing. I don't know, how many of you have read the Da Vinci Code, the book, or seen the movie? It's like massive. My whole understanding of it is follow the money. And I mean, there's workbooks on how to debunk the Da Vinci Code, and there's a whole industry. Now there's a Da Vinci diet, there's Da Vinci cups, there's Da Vinci t-shirts. You know, to me, that's what it's about. But nonetheless, it is there. But however, one of the themes is how the voice of women has been devalued for the last 2,000 years. And in the voice of women, what has been devalued about the voice of women is the nurturing from the reading that we just read, is the caring, is the movement toward peace. And I think if anything, we ought to take that literature, that movie, that book, and raise that issue. that this is the great, this is a secret that has been kept, that there has been a devaluation. We have in the book of Proverbs chapter 31, chapter 10, and it reads like this in this translation: who can find a virtuous woman? Well, in the original language, that word virtuous doesn't mean virtuous at all. It's talking about a woman of valor, a woman of honor, a woman who has power, a woman who goes out of the community and negotiates real estate deals, which can be quite difficult, a woman who can go out in the community and who can manage a massive organization. It doesn't talk about a virtuous woman who stays at home with the image that we get from a virtuous woman. That's not what it's about at all. And the translation that we have, it is another diminishing of the power of nurturing and care. And this powerful woman, it says this about her, as she is like the ships of the merchants, and she has a strength, and it also says she stretches out her hand to the poor, and she reaches for the needs to take care of the needs of the needy. So we have to ask ourselves, what is it that moves us to stand against peace, liberty, and justice? I've been doing psychotherapy for over a decade, and this isn't just a national issue. From my own personal lives and talking with other persons, we have a belief that if we worked through something personally, our lives would be more at ease, there'd be greater calm in our lives, but we might resist visiting those parts of our history that we know we have to visit in order to get to the other side. It moves with that theological tenet. Home is on the other side of despair. But none of us wants to go through the despair. But if we don't go through the despair, we don't get home. Sometimes it's hard to get to the place where we have peace, liberty, and justice. It's not easy. I thought after the children's story, I might as well sit down and recognize who's doing the preaching and the sermon these days. Because what are we willing to change in order to have that? Definition of peace: freedom from war, mental calm, a peace treaty, law and order. And I got to thinking about these from the perspective of family systems, from the perspective of counseling. And the first one, the freedom of war, reminded me of that when you, say, think about the formation of a church. When reading the book Generation to Generation, Milton Friedman writes that the dysfunction in the beginning of the church can be seen 30 years later, 100 years later. The origins, the formation of that group of people will travel with it through time. So after I read that, I had my counseling office in a Baptist church that was over 100 years old, and there had some people there who were in their 80s and who had been in that church since their 80s, and I said, yeah, I'm not sure I believe that. But I also know dysfunction from families travel one generation to one generation, so I've got some energy to believe that. So I started interviewing these people. And what I discovered was, for at least 80 years, every time they'd bring in a new minister, everybody was all excited at the first diminishing of the shine of that new minister. The inkling that something was wrong, there began a diminishing of the service of that minister, and then eventually a new minister. And that pattern has gone on for years. Everybody's excited, one glitch, down, new minister. Everybody's excited, one glitch, down, a new minister. What that alerted me to, there's no reconciliation after the first injury. There's no method of reconciliation. So that, like in any relationship, we are going to have diminishes. We're going to have disappointments. We're going to have broken promises. It just happens. But yet in this particular church, there was no way to reconcile and get back on track. There was only excitement, down, end. So it got me thinking that there's somewhat true to that. Now, when we do couples work, we know that there is, in any couple, there's something called the first disillusionment. It's when we recognize all the good stuff that we see in this other person, or all the good stuff this other person evokes in me. Sometimes that's really more what it's about, that you make me feel good. When that has its first diminishing, how that couple handles that can determine how they're going to live the rest of their lives together or not. And sometimes people live the rest of their lives together believing that this relationship is not going to be all that it could have been for me. But it's okay. So I'm not going to be fully celebrative like I was at one point. I'm going to be a little bit diminished, but this is my lot in life, and I guess I'm not going to have that for my life. So I just go through time diminished. But it's all right. My life's good. I have good things. What that lets us know, again, there's no form of reconciliation. There's no form of those two people getting together and saying, yeah, this happened. This is what I thought. Yeah, this is what happened. This is what I thought. They're either talking the same, or often in couples, the communication system, they're really missing each other. But they're able to get together, talk about it, grieve the loss, and then reinvest and bring back the deep intimacy and bring back the love and bring back the hope and live on and develop a style of reconciling, because as we go through times, we will do things. We are poor lovers. We will do things that are intrusive. We will say things we don't want to say, and we will be absent times when we ought to have been more present. It's the way relationships are. It's no different for a nation. If it's that way for the church, if it's that way for a couple, why would it be different for the community of a nation? When we go back and we think about our nation and the birth of our nation, what we are taught is this glorious democracy forms out of history like nothing ever before. The writings of some Unitarians or Socinians we like to contribute. John Locke, the classics, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Washington brings these things together, writes the Declaration, writes the Constitution, and it's a wonderful thing, and here comes this democracy, this new experiment in history. And that's what we like to think about. But like in any family system, we don't like to think about the shaming events. We don't like to think about the events where we're the offender, or where we're absent when we should be present. We also have the affirmation of slavery. We also have the affirmation of genocide. We also have the affirmation of the oppression of women. We also have the affirmation of oppression against anybody that did not own land. Only white men who own land could vote. Those things are also in our history. And we need to pay attention to those things if we are going to be able to have peace, liberty, and justice in our culture. For example, John Adams didn't like the way things were going during his term, and he implemented the Alien Sedition Act, where you couldn't talk about the country, where it became oppressive, where civil liberties were suspended. Abraham Lincoln suspended civil liberties. We know that Woodrow Wilson suspended civil liberties. We know that when Franklin Roosevelt was first elected, a lot of people thought Franklin Roosevelt was going to move toward fascism and a dictatorship, because fascism and dictatorship was fashionable. People liked what Mussolini was doing. They thought that was going to happen in our country because of the Great Depression. This was going to be the only way to deal with that. And I find it in the book just recently out, I was reading that, called The First 100 Days of the Administration of FDR. So we have the expectation that it was going to be okay to suspend Congress. We also have it in the era of McCarthy, the suspension of civil liberties. We also have it today, the struggle of the suspension of civil liberties. It has been there since our beginning, and we've yet to deal with it, and we have yet to own the offenses and the injuries we have caused others because of that particular dynamic. Speaking of suspending the power of Congress, we talked about last week how presidents have the authority that when the legislation is passed, they can also sign a bill in quiet, saying they are not obligated to follow the law of that legislation. Well, if Congress passing the legislation, and you can sign 750 of those bills, that you can not obey 750 laws that come through Congress. Now, Roosevelt, they were saying, well, he's going to suspend Congress, and that would be an overt suspension of Congress, and there were a lot of people for that. But what happens if you just suspend the boundaries that laws put on you as an administration? Have you suspended Congress? It's a thought. Have you suspended Congress if you don't have to deal with the legislation Congress passes? Which they thought Roosevelt was moving toward fascism. We don't know what that might mean for today, but yet here it is. Christopher Bolas, a psychoanalytical writer, says that just as people who are offenders, just as people who cross boundaries, must move back in time and own their offenses in order to bring their self to a position of reconciliation with others. It is the only way to reconcile with others, to start again, just as we need to do that as individuals. Nations, he says, need to do that as well. If a nation doesn't move back and deal with its offenses, it can never reconcile with itself, with its citizens, and others who are not in that, in other countries. Not apologize for our offenses, as, say, one religious group has apologized to the African Americans because of their viewpoint on slavery during slavery, because African Americans are now becoming more in the middle class and have money and they want to court them. Not an apology like that, but an apology out of remorse. An apology out of, yes, I did cross that boundary. Yes, as a nation, we did support this. Yes, as a nation, we did lock up Japanese. Yes, as a nation, we did act imperialistically. Yes, as a nation, we did endorse slavery and use slavery. And if we were to really apologize for those infractions, we would find out what it meant, and then we would do something about what it means. We would consider the idea of reparations. Whatever that might mean, we would at least consider it. If we do not, as a nation, remember the infractions that we have committed, and as a nation we have, there's lots of good things about our country, and I'm not saying that there are not. There are, because we have the capacity to reflect and do this remembrance and call forth a peace department that I think would need to have this in it. If we do that, we have a chance for peace, liberty, and justice. If we do not, we will continue to be offensive. We will continue to be intrusive. We will continue to disregard our poor. We will continue to disregard those in need of health care. We will continue the widening gap of the wealth if we do not stop and reflect on what we've done and where we've come from. The Unitarian Universalist Seven Principles are difficult, because they call us to stop. And whether I'm right on every idea here or not is not really what this is about. These principles call us to stop and reflect and try to understand why liberty and justice. We don't have to go far to see that there's injustice. Go to any courtroom. Go do any search on prison labor. We don't have to go far to find out that there's not justice in our country. And then we must begin with ourselves. At peace with here. We have peace. We can't possess peace. You must become peace in yourself. That's where we start. And I'm going to encourage us somehow to come together and try to have a voice in this community that supports something like Dennis Kucinich. And send that voice out into the community and find out how we are received or not received. This principle is a different principle, but it's at the heart of who we are. And I say, let's own it and work with it and try to understand it.